The Institute on Religious Life brings you the following in a series of lectures given by one of today's leading theologians, Father John A. Hardin, S.J. In this following lecture, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, How to Counsel Religious. Father Hardin.
Lest I spend much more time on Section 3, because we've got a lot of 4 to cover, can I ask for an input? Was that the plan on today's feast? Contribution from you? Brother, could you start us off? Now, may I suggest, in order that we manage to cover all that I think needs to be covered of each of these sections with its 3 parts, to sort of concentrate what you have to say, I will react, ask for a response from the audience, then we go on. All right, brother?
I have 2 questions that, if I could please read them to you, and you could see where they fit in, if they fit in. One is a question on time off. If a novice, for instance, subjectively feels he needs time off.
He needs?
Time off.
Time off.
Yes, and I'm specifically... for instance, the problem I'm having is if they would like to go to confession downtown St. Peter's, well, fine, we have a train depot just a block from us to have the train go down there. But it might be 2 or 3 extra hours in there of window shopping or something, maybe just to get away from the novitiate and then coming back. That's one question. Do you think that...
Well, I would say the wiser thing would be to provide that the novitiate structure be such as to have ample, quotes, time off. In other words, now I don't know, but there are novitiates that are so highly structured that legitimately and understandably the novices would feel, I've got to get away from it all for at least a few hours, otherwise I'd either burst a blood vessel or do something violent.
Well, Father, I give Sunday as a day off, except for the evening we get together again. But Sunday, everything is closed. Does that make a difference? Should I restructure the program?
Well, I would say, judging by my own experience and the experience of now centuries of successful novitiate formation programs, within a week, in any given week, there should be at least one day that is relatively freer than other days. And from St. Ignatius' time on, see, I have to speak from the context in which I was myself trained and that I'm most familiar with. Each novitiate day, even the most demanding, had, and the Latin, because within 8 days of entering the novitiate, we were forbidden to talk English, except during recreation. Then even there we were forbidden to talk English during the whole recreation. A bell would ring when you have to start talking Latin. So all the signs were in Latin. Ignatius provided for tempus liberum, free time every day. Now some people would appreciate choosing their free time. Well, needless to say, that's one luxury that I don't think a novice has a right to. The assumption is the person is normal enough to be able to take a balanced novitiate program. So at least one day a week when things are less structured, and during each day, now the amount of time, and that can be adjusted, it's best not to so standardize things that when you run into some real problem that it's unusual if you all of a sudden have extra free time. I would say the one thing that should not be encouraged in the novitiate is singularity. So I think prudent foresight in us so overstructuring has to make it maybe necessary for some people to just want out at least for a while. But I would say if a person really has a need, but then on a couple of hour program there should be some real need for going to town. See? And going to confession to St. Peter's, there are a lot of good confessors, I'm sure, nearer than St. Peter's downtown. So, I think by anticipation, so as not to overdo it and find out from the novices how they're doing. What I mean is, and don't ask them, do you think you need more free time? The odds are, if you're a novice that doesn't think they need more free time. Does that help a little bit?
I have another question. How differently should chronologically older novices be treated? Should the novitiate program be geared differently, and how?
What do you mean? Did you say chronologically?
Yes, chronologically older.
You mean the hours?
If the novices are chronological, say in their 40s or maybe older than that, should they?
Well, this of course,
problem, and, I don't know.
And this is not an out, but I would say some kind of a golden mean. Now, in teaching class, because this is something that applies to a class, you don't usually have big age levels, but you surely have big intellectual gaps, from the near genius to the person who can just make it, and they're all in the same class. So the two extremes to avoid: not to gear the novitiate structure or demands, say, to the youngest, because that could make it very difficult for those who are older, nor conversely for the oldest. I think a certain amount of orientation at the very beginning, where you think it through and explain, depending on whom you've got, needless to say, you're different, say in age and background and so on. We'll try as far as possible to adjust to everybody, but they must be told it's impossible. Life is not that adjustable. When the sun shines, it shines on everybody. When it's cold, the cold blows on everybody. Right? That's the Lord. Now, the Lord has wisely provided for when it rains, we can put something on. When it's cold, you can put more clothes on or turn on the heat. If it works, which I've discovered in New York, doesn't always work. I would then suggest rather providing for novices that need, to use the symbolic language, an extra coat or a little extra heat. You know what I'm saying? To adjust to individuals as they come along, rather than trim the program to meet some kind of unrealistic and unreliable golden mean. One of my rules, which I've set myself: anyone who tries to please everybody ends up by pleasing nobody. Does that help? Sister Linda, you seem to be.
My question has to do with the first point under number four, how to counsel religious. And I think I think of this counseling in terms of spiritual direction. And I think that what my first question would be is that I've heard in, you know, a lot of, from different formation people, that the role of the person in formation should not also have the role of spiritual director. And I find that very difficult, because I don't know what I would do in training or helping novices and postulants if I didn't know that side of the person. So my question is...
Well, I would say, put it just that way, no matter how highly placed the person who originated that comment, in my very modest opinion, that's not true. What the person may have meant, possible, is that there is a role that no directors of novices, no superior, can play, and that is that sacramental function that a priest, because we're dealing with the Catholic Church, is supposed to provide everyone from the youngest postulant to the golden jubilarians. If by spiritual direction he has meant that sacramental provision that only a priest can give, but then I wouldn't call it spiritual direction. Because any time the confessor tries to substitute, and some do, for the role of the directors of novices, there is conflict. And I see the conflict is not only a priori, you would expect. Even two good people trying to direct the same person, there is bound to be conflict, at least apparent conflict, which, as far as the young person is concerned, can be as real as the Himalayas. But they think it's a real conflict, and that's enough to create a problem. But secondly, having taught so many priests, there are some who frankly think that no soul is properly directed unless they direct it. Now, there are priests who are reluctant to give even basic advice, which they should give in the confessional. But there are others that are not reluctant at all. And especially when the penitent confesses something which may involve, say, the one being in charge. I have been unkind. I've had very nasty thoughts. Well, about whom? Well, about the novice directors. Oh, you did? Well, what's wrong with her? And the novice begins to pour out her complaints against the novice directress. And this is in the sacrament. Between the two genders, men and women, I would give the prize for naivete to men. There's a built-in realism about women. Now, you sisters know what problems women can have. But by and large, women tend to keep their feet on the ground. And men, for example, I'm talking about penitents, come for counsel or confession and maybe some advice. Often the man doesn't think straight. He wants to be the generous, gallant knight who wants to save this poor young thing from the authoritarianism of those who have charge of her. So, if you're not giving spiritual direction, you've got no business being in charge of formation. And I would be delighted if you quoted me, and if necessary, tell me who it is and have them call me up collect. Any other comments on number one?
Father, I agree with you, but yet I can foresee a problem. Is it not true that what we might learn as in the role of spiritual director cannot be used, is privileged matter and cannot be used?
Oh yes, that's confidentiality.
But on the other hand, if I am to make a recommendation as novice master, I can use the matter I learned as spiritual director.
Oh yes, you can, in two ways. You can use the matter vicariously by telling your charge to really inform the person that normally you would inform. In other words, something needs to be done, or some So one way is for the person, say him or herself, to identify whatever needs to be done, and they do it themselves. And often they want to, as it were, pass the buck to you and have you solve a problem which may be largely their own. So put the responsibility on them to somehow expose or reveal, not just to you in confidence, but to tell them to identify themselves to the person or persons who can do something about it. And secondly, you can always ask permission. So never feel that because you receive confidential matter, your hands are tied. In fact, even in the confessional, a priest, now he shouldn't do this normally, and only very rarely, but if it's a very serious matter, and it cannot be solved by either the person himself or by you, the confessor, you can oblige the person in the sacrament. Oblige them under sin to reveal it to somebody else. Right? And if it's something which involves sin, you can even tell them, if they show their reluctance, well, this may be the first time in your life, but I will have to withhold your absolution unless you promise that you will reveal it. You follow that? So the church provides, because no doubt there are things that just by being talked over will not be solved. So don't hesitate. Either to lay the burden on the person, him or herself, to make such public or at least overt manifestation as may be necessary, or if necessary and the person is reluctant or whatever, and you're willing to undertake it, to get permission.
Sister? I'm just wondering, if say a person does reveal something that's of conscience to you, and then you get that person to also reveal it to, you know, say another person who you feel really needs to know, can the two persons whom then talk it over after it's been revealed to both persons?
Not without, again, at least, you cannot assume. In these things you don't assume. Ask the person, and there are ways of doing this. You don't have to do it each time these things come up. Periodically, and have a little speech. Don't read it, but have a little speech available and telling the people, now there are certain things that I will not be able to resolve by myself, that I will ask you to let me share this with somebody else. Now, normally it should be done, especially in any matters of moment, each time. But one way to do it, provided you repeat yourself often enough so they know what you're doing, is to tell them, now, if you want me to keep it confidential, let me know. If you don't, I will assume that you're giving me permission. But that should be said often enough to make it clear to the person or persons that what they are telling you then may be used by you to inform someone else. Any others? Brother?
Father, I have a problem. I had one which was resolved this year, but I'm afraid I'm going to run into it again next year. May I advise novices not to go to a particular priest for confession, even on an individual, rather than a continuing basis, even because I've run across, I've found that because of the proximity of all his remarks, a local priest, he has in fact revealed confessional matter. And I don't know where I stand. I don't know who. I certainly would like to say, please stay away from him. But
well, I would say you are not only justified, but it would be an obligation even to keep your people away from that priest. I would like to think that it wasn't, a direct breach of the seal, because that's very great matter.
No, it wasn't a direct, but you see, when you add things to
various facts, in other words, he may talk loosely, injudiciously, and then people put two and two together and come up with four.
That's right.
Yeah, I would say this is In fact, one of the graver responsibilities of those in charge of formation, first to make sure that you have a sufficient supply of good confessors, and not to live, as it were, from hand to mouth, or from one week to the next, wondering who's going to come across your horizon the next time. Because good confessors are absolutely necessary for a good community. One reason, there must be others, but I think one reason why the church's law was mitigated from once a week to once every 2 weeks for religious, though there are communities that by their own constitutional rule have confession every week, the Daughters of St. Paul, for example. And yet, good, conscientious priests who are prudent, well, they have never been in oversupply, but they're becoming even more rare, and those priests are found out rather quickly, and they're, as you would expect, used. There are priests, and some of our retired priests, as they call them. To me, this is one of the great tragedies of our modern post-conciliar America. How many thousands of retired priests that are just looking for work to be done, good men, would be delighted and available. You go through the Chicago Directory and you want to weep. It's a good two solid columns of priests that are supposedly retired. No priest retires. So, yes. And not only that, but I mean, even on the odd chance that somebody might go to confession, if a priest is, and you know it, remember, the person who goes to confession is not bound by the seal. They can reveal, I don't mean going around telling everybody, but they may reveal whatever they've been told or heard or experienced in the confessional. And they could be asked. And I would say, priests like that should not be available. And to make sure you've got, you know, a priest or priests available, quietly, reminded and warned even, and then released. Well, any others? That was just number one. Now, I have a few things to say too, if I may, though I preempted in giving the answers. The first question under section 4 is how to counsel religious. I begin by distinguishing the word counsel as used by the church in two different senses. First, as something which is distinct from command, and secondly, as a gift of the Holy Spirit. On the first level, in counseling religious, the verb, of course, comes from the noun. What those in formation have a right to do, and as counselors, that's all they may do, is advise, recommend. And as I analyze counseling, I would break it up into four pieces. First, you counsel another person by appealing to their generosity. And as such, of course, it is the very opposite of telling people what to do. You appeal to their generosity with all the means that are at your disposal and the person is able to take amicably. Secondly, as a means of formation, counseling means offering concrete means of becoming holy. In many cases, I believe, religious are not more generous, not because they don't want to be, but they frankly don't know how to do it. These means have to be adjusted to each individual. What is good for one may not be good for someone else. And this is where the more you can know about the person, the more effectively you can counsel. Now, with some, the Ignatian maxim, agere contra, acting against, that's the way to do it. You fight against your evil inclinations, and that's the most successful means. With some people, that wouldn't work. Thirdly, counseling religious means assuring religious that they have the strength to do what the religious life expects of them. I didn't know this before my priesthood. I sure know it now. I think most people suffer from lack of confidence, and they can often, without intending to, deceive you. Some of the most insecure people are the braggarts, the aggressive, the outspoken, the people who hide their insecurity under a facade of bravery or courage or outspokenness.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.